Next up is John Allen Paulos, professor of mathematics at Temple University in Philadelphia. You probably read his, know about his book Innumeracy, Mathematician Plays the Stock Market, various things. But his new book is Irreligion, A Mathematician Explains Why the Arguments for God Just Won't Add Up. So, add up to more than 33?
Actually, thank you, Roger. It's a pleasure to be here. It's uncanny, the structure of my book, Irreligion, Why Mathematician Explains Why the Arguments for God Just Don't Add Up, has a structure uncannily similar to that of Cass Seltzer's. Except and not only that, there's an incident in the book in which I talk about the bunk beds my brother and I used to sleep on. So anyway, let's put that aside. Anyway, you might wonder what contributions a mathematician might make to the topics of this conference, and might suspect them of perhaps being exemplified by the story of the three statisticians who went duck hunting. You may have heard that the first statistician took a shot at the duck and it sailed about 6 inches over the duck. The next statistician took a shot and hit about 6 inches in front of the duck, whereupon the third one jumped up and down excitedly. We got him, we got him. Anyway. Rather than talk about the book directly, I'll talk about certain aspects of it obliquely. One particular aspect is the role of probability in people's tendency to believe. Let me talk, for example, of the Bible codes, so-called equidistant letter sequences embedded in them. But rather than talk about them directly, let me talk about a lesser-known code and discovered by researchers at the Cato Institute. And they found that embedded in the U.S. Constitution are equidistant letter sequences foretelling the Clinton sex scandals. And the logic is exactly the same. The language is English rather than Hebrew, but let me briefly go through that. Imagine that one of these researchers points out that a particular place in the Constitution, there's a letter B, and then you move ahead 23 letters, there's a letter I, another 23 letters, an L, another 23 letters, another L. And nearby, at a particular point, there's the letter M. You move ahead 89 letters, there's a letter O, another 89 letters, letter N, and then I, C, A, space 89 letters apart. And then they ask, what is the probability of these letters appearing at these particular spots? And the answer, of course, is minuscule, vanishingly small. But it's not the right question. The right question is, what's the probability of something of this general sort occurring? So you don't have to start at this particular point in the Constitution to look for the B. You can start anywhere. You don't have to look ahead 23 letters or 89. You could look ahead 26, 38, whatever. You don't have to go forwards. You could go backwards. You could go diagonally. You don't have to look for Monica. You could look for Paula or Jennifer or Kathleen or whatever. But with all these degrees of freedom, it's not too surprising that something of this general sort would occur. But if you look before the fact and then go public with what you found, it seems superficially impressive. If you mistake the a priori probability of some specific event with the a fortiori probability of some class of events. And this is kind of a common move that people do all the time, including creationists. They say, what's the probability of this sequence of mutations that lead from A to B, and each one of those mutations has a certain low probability, and assuming independence, let's say, the probability of the whole sequence is, again, minuscule. But again, it's not the right question. It's not the probability that this specific sequence would occur, but the probability of something occurring that would result in something viable. And as I say, that's done all the time. I mean, it would be analogous to someone being dealt a bridge hand. You got these 13 cards, and you look at it, and you say, wow, I couldn't have got this hand. The probability of this hand is 1 in 600 billion. It's true. But it doesn't mean you didn't get that hand. There's ways to illustrate that, to actually physically. I sometimes bring a spinner to class with the letters of the alphabet around the periphery, and A, B, C, D, all the way through Z, and then say I'm going to spin it 100 times and record the sequence of letters that I get. And it's not hard to show, looking at the probability of various letters that in this case, it'll all be 126, but the probability that the word cat will appear somewhere in the sequence, 100-letter sequence, is small. Probability the word dog will appear is small. The probability the word chrysanthemum will appear is small. But the probability of something appearing is, of course, quite high, and it's very easy to confuse the a priori probability with what happens. And more generally, people have a very poor understanding of randomness. Randomness is hard to recognize often. An exercise I do sometimes in probability class is I split the class in half and I direct them to half the class when they go home to flip a coin 100 times and record the sequence of heads and tails. And the other half I direct to just make up a sequence of heads and tails that's 100 units long that they think is somewhat typical, generic, whatever. And with probability 90-95%, when they hand them in the next class period, I can tell the difference. And the reason is that when people make up the heads and tails sequence, they don't put in enough consecutive runs of heads and tails. They don't put enough runs. The runs aren't long enough, and various other tests are failed. So people can't. Actually, there's another property of randomness that is even more counterintuitive. Let's say you flip a coin 10,000 times rather than 100 times, and you ask people to keep track of the difference between the number of heads and tails up to any particular point. So if they flipped it 20 times, heads might be ahead 11 to 9. They flipped it 32 times, heads might be ahead 18 to 14 or whatever. You might think that if you kept track of the lead, that heads would be ahead about half the time during this 10,000 sequence hedgerow, and tails would be ahead about half the time. But it's much more likely that tails will be ahead almost the whole time, or that heads will be ahead almost the whole time. And very unlikely that they'll go back and forth, and roughly half the time heads will be ahead and half the time tails will be ahead. It's called the arc-sine law. So people have, as I say, a very poor understanding of randomness. It's one reason investors, particularly technical analysts, tend to be so wed to their little funny symbols or whatever. They talk about double bottoms and triple head and shoulders and all kinds of things to describe patterns of stock movements, and are resistant to the notion that it may be not random. You don't have to be a strict random walk theorist, but largely random. Relating to the topic of the conference, or one of the topics, God and so on, creationists, among other people, tend to say, look at the complexity of people, look at the complexity of animals, of the world, look at the extreme improbability of that resulting by chance. And to explain this extreme improbability, they invoke an even more improbable creator, which somehow fashioned this improbability. Reminds me of a friend of mine whose girlfriend in college used to use these crazy mnemonic devices to remember telephone numbers. So if you ask her the number, and she said, "Oh, the Passalls have two kids, and they have six dogs, and my friend lived with the seven brothers," and this long story for every telephone number, and she thought that somehow she was achieving some great something efficient. I talk a little bit about cognitive biases in the book, which, of course, are relevant. The so-called availability error, the availability heuristic. I mean, we tend to view any story through the lens of a story that's superficially similar. Whether it has anything to do with the real story or not is something else. I mean, in the case of the Iraq War, if you viewed it early on as in the light of national liberation, you might be more willing to have supported it than if you saw it as something analogous to Vietnam. And it probably has nothing to do with either, but we tend to view any story through the lens of superficially similar stories, which is one reason, for example, even now, I mean, so many candidates, Republicans in particular, invoke 9/11 every other sentence to keep it psychologically available. Actually, there's some interesting recent research about that's relevant to availability here, and that has to do with denials. There's a guy at Michigan in the psychology department, I think his name is Norman, I think it's Norman, I'm not sure the first name, Norman Schwartz. In any case, he got some flyers from the CDC talking about misconceptions that people have about the flu virus, because he was concerned that people didn't get their flu shots. And he had people read it. It's a list of true facts and misconceptions about the flu virus. And then later he tested them, and most of they forgot it fairly soon. But they tended to misremember, and worse than that, I mean they quickly forgot. But worse than that, they attributed their misconceptions now to the CDC. that's unfortunate. Anchoring effect is somewhat similar. People are anchored to the first number that's presented to them, whether it has anything to do with reality or not. Confirmation bias, we're aware of, particularly with regard to Iraq again. Another lesser known is conjunction fallacy, which goes back to the early days of Kahneman and Tversky, which talks about, it's one of its names. I mean, the conjunctions are always less likely than either of the conjuncts. But you can tell a story in such a way that the story kind of obscures that fact. I mean, there's a famous Linda story, and Linda went to some prestigious university. She majored in philosophy. She was active in the anti-war movement. She was this and that. And then you ask, is she does she work in the bank as a bank teller? Or B, does she work as a bank teller and is active in Move On or something like that? And most people will say, well, the second is more likely. And satisfying two parts of the conjunction is less likely than satisfying one. And the relevance of this, I mean, it might be strained to religion, but anytime you embed a story embed God, for example, or any character in a story with lots of details, it makes it seem much more plausible than it otherwise would. I mean, you suspend disbelief, and it seems like the character actually does exist. And let's see, I wasn't going to talk about that. Another bias, which doesn't necessarily have a name, is an over-reliance or the tendency to be over-impressed by precision. I mean, if you give people, some people, especially if they don't have a mathematical background, a precise number, they're often much more impressed than they would be if you just gave what is really justified by a situation like 23 or 20 more or less or 2,000 more or less. And they also tend to value. Let me give an example. Since I'm skipping around, and that's why I'm floundering a bit, because I didn't want to talk for 45 minutes. people, for example, are let's say you look at something as banal as a recipe in the food section of a paper. And it's a very nebulous directions, and a couple of this, a few medium-sized that, some of this. And at the end, it says that this recipe makes four servings, each with 721 calories. and or 22.6 grams of sodium. And you know, you wonder where does that precision come from? But most people read that and they just nod, oh, okay, 22.6 grams of sodium. Reminds me of the story of the guard at the Museum of Natural History. He used to claim that the dinosaur on exhibit was 70 million and 6 years old. And once he was challenged by a patron, how do you know it's 70 million and 6 years old? He says, well, they told me it was 70 million years old when they hired me 6 years ago. But actually, it's a way to distinguish people to some extent if you don't push it too hard, but between those who have a math and science background and those who don't. Because if you have a math and science background and somebody cites a number with three or four significant digits, the natural response is to be wary. Like, how do you know that four significant digits? Whereas if you don't, people tend to be really impressed. Why, this guy really knows his stuff. talking about probabilities, the figure that was cited yesterday that, 93% subscribe to one or another kind of absurd statement. I think that those kinds of statements aren't very reliable. People agree to just about anything. And I mean, as, you know, you always hear about sex surveys that seem reliable, but then they say that men have the average man has 8.2 partners and the average woman has 3.6, and you know that's not possible. Pardon?
Self partners.
Yeah, my best friend. Actually, another instance of the same phenomena is Viagra. I mean, until the introduction of Viagra, whenever it was, 8-10 years ago, I mean, there were 17 American men who suffered from ED, and now apparently there are more. I don't know. Anyway, I could blather on and talk about the various arguments. I mean, the book does focus not on 33, but on 12 arguments, and there are some uncanny similarities between Cass Seltzer and not me, but his book and mine. But I'll let them be. Let me instead of doing that, just read a couple of short excerpts that are relevant. The first one is relevant to Michael Shermer's comments yesterday on economics, and so let me start with that. How is it that modern free market economies are as complex as they are, boasting amazingly elaborate production, distribution, and communication systems? Go into almost any drugstore and you can find your favorite candy bar. Every supermarket has your brand of spaghetti sauce, or the store down the block does. Your size and style of jeans are in every neighborhood. And what's true at the personal level is true at the industrial level. Somehow there are enough ball bearings and computer chips in just the right places and factories all over the country. The physical infrastructure and communications networks are also marvels of integrated complexity. Oil and gas supplies are, by and large, where they're needed. Your email reaches you in Miami as well as Milwaukee, not to mention Barcelona and Bangkok. The natural question, discussed first by Adam Smith and later by Hayek and Popper, among others, who designed this marvel of complexity? Which commissar decreed the number of packets of dental floss for each retail outlet? The answer, of course, is that no economic god designed this system. It emerged and grew by itself, a stunningly obvious example of spontaneously evolving order. No one argues that all of the components of the candy bar distribution system must have been put in place at once, irreducible complexity, or else there would be no Snickers at the corner store. So far, so good. What is more than a bit odd, however, is that some of the most ardent opponents of Darwinian evolution, for example, many fundamentalist Christians, are among the most ardent supporters of the free market. These people accept the natural complexity of the market without qualm, yet they insist that the natural complexity of biological phenomena requires a designer. They would reject the idea that there is or should be central planning in the economy. They would rightfully point out that simple economic exchanges that are beneficial to people become entrenched and then gradually modified and improved as they become part of larger systems of exchange, while those that are not beneficial gradually die out. They accept the claim that Adam Smith's invisible hand brings about the spontaneous order of the modern economy. Yet, as noted, some of these same people refuse to believe that natural selection and, quote, blind processes can lead to similar biological order acting spontaneously. And the refusals, if responses to some of my religiously tinged books and columns are at all typical, generally range from vituperative to venomous, with most clustering around the latter. I write a column for abcnews.com, and it reaches a broad swath of American and world population, actually. And I get very many nasty letters. The nastiest usually begin, "Dear Sir." So, NOAA's great intelligence required software dating back to Conway's Game of Life, utilizing very simple, mindless rules of interaction between virtual agents, leads to similar sorts of economic complexities. These ideas aren't new. As mentioned, Smith, Hayek, Popper, and others have made them more or less explicitly. There are, of course, quite significant differences in disanalogies between biological systems and economic ones, one being that biology is a much more substantive science than economics, but that shouldn't blind us to their similarities or mask the obvious analogies. These analogies prompt two final questions. What would you think of someone who studied economic entities and their interactions in a modern free market economy and insisted that they were, despite a perfectly reasonable and empirically supported account of their development, the consequence of some all-powerful, detail-obsessed economic lawgiver? You might deem such a person a conspiracy theorist. And what would you think of someone who studied biological processes and organisms and insisted that they were, despite a perfectly reasonable and empirically supported Darwinian account of their development, the consequence of some all-powerful, detail-obsessed biological lawgiver? Well, I'll leave it up to you how you want to characterize them. One other brief excerpt I want to read is prompted by my discussion with Rebecca at lunch yesterday. She talked about her book this kind of resonance, a loose resonance between love and God. And it's a little anecdote from the book, a little digression, but it's brief. I was in a beach town in Thailand on Christmas Day 2006 and passed a rather remote internet cafe where there were three girls giggling and periodically running up to one or another of the 10 or so computers in the room. After checking my email briefly, I noticed that there were webcams on all the computers. At intervals, the cameras snapped pictures of the young women who were sending instant messages in quick succession to 9 lovesick and lonely farangs. It's Thai for foreigners. So they'd send the message, they'd click, and they'd run on to the next one. I mean, just one would send it, click, and run on to the next one. Often just Thai for foreigners around the world mooning for their, quote, true loves at Christmas. Apparently, the men, who all appeared middle-aged, had met the girls on earlier visits to Thailand. When new pictures of their admirers appeared on the monitors, the girls would all laugh, and the English, quote, expert among them would write something endearing and ultimately money-extracting to each of them. The three girls would then quickly move on to another of their samis, which is Thai for boyfriends or husbands. Seeing my interest, they occasionally asked me what certain words in the emails meant. I explained that pine for you meant miss you very much. Obsessed with you meant think about you all the time, and so on. And so I kept coming up to ask. Then they asked me what else they could say, so I coached them a bit. And my lines got very good responses from their samis, causing them to laugh uproariously. They thanked me and pumped me for more good lines, which I happily provided for quite some time. In one form or another, most promised bliss to their samis in Thailand in 2007. This was Christmas 2006. It was great fun helping them dupe farangs on 3 continents out of their money via Western Union office down the block. Perhaps dupe is the wrong word, however, since I think the bargain was a fair one and inexpensive at that, a Christmas fantasy for a few dollars. I realized that Christopher Moore, a Bangkok-based novelist and a friend of mine whose compelling mysteries are set in Thailand,
jokingly remarked that Thai has no common word or phrase for rigid integrity, but many for fun and smiles. This vignette may seem far removed from the topic of this book, but it serves as an apt introduction to the next two arguments about faith and miracles. The incident came to mind when I thought of the intense need that many people have to believe in a divinity. Even if they're aware of gaping holes in the arguments for God, they want to believe as badly as the Farangs wanted to believe in their Thai girlfriends, who were, in a sense, their goddesses. I suspect that the latter also felt a bit more than their charmingly lighthearted laughter and seemingly mercenary behavior might suggest. And what of my role, which, despite my rationale above, remains highly problematic? I was doing the opposite of what I'm attempting to do in this book. I was facilitating an illusion, albeit an emotional one, with which I have more sympathy than its religio-intellectual analog. Is this just a roundabout and sappy way of saying that though I don't believe in God, I do believe in love, even deluded love? Perhaps it is, or it might suggest there are more things in heaven and on earth, or at least on earth, than are dreamed of in my philosophy. More likely, it's just a marginally relevant anecdote. In any case, the bottom line is that I don't want to scoff too much at emotional need, whether it be of love or of God. I just don't possess the latter. Anyway, okay. Well, in any case, that's a taste of the book, and that's my talk. Thanks. Thank you. Be happy to entertain any questions if there are
Jerry
any.
Jerry Ostrom has a question up there.
Yes. Wherever it is.
Thank you, John. And I always thought there were three kinds of mathematicians in the world: those who can count and those who can't.
Okay.
Da-dum-bum. John, your fair criticism of right-wingers who, while embracing the self-organization bottom-up of the free market, fail to embrace the same concept in evolution can equally be applied to left-wingers, the converse thereof, who happily embrace bottom-up self-organization of evolution without embracing, while not embracing, the self-organization of the free market. I just point that out. A question for you. It's my understanding, although I don't know where to point to the documentation for this, that among scientists, mathematicians tend to be more highly represented among believers than the other sciences. Do you know if that's true? And if so, why do you suppose that is so?
I've read that it's true, and it seems that it is true in my informal surveying of my colleagues. I think part of the reason is maybe just the habit of thinking axiomatically. I mean, you can derive everything from, thinking axiomatically and not worrying about the facts, not worrying about the world. So, I mean, if you, you know, can torture a proof as somewhat similar, let's say, to Gödel's proof. I mean, Gödel had a proof of God, which is very tortured. But mathematicians, I think, do just tend to accept some basic axiom, which seems kind of plausible. I mean, I'm trying to read into their psychology since I don't share it. But accept something that seems reasonably plausible, and then through very subtle reasoning, deriving that there is a God. Maybe not a personal God, but a God of some sort, maybe an Einsteinian God.
Do you think Platon? They're more likely to be Platonists?
And yeah, mathematicians. I mean, tend. I mean, even if they're not formally Platonists, I mean, they might disavow Platonism, say, "I'm not a Platonist." But their whole habit, their whole way of thinking, I mean, is necessarily Platonic. If you're doing mathematics, you're imagining these ideal entities, real numbers or rings or whatever your specialty is, and they exist in some vague quasi-Platonic realm. So. Psychologically, they're Platonists, even if they don't necessarily ascribe to Platonism. And being mathematicians, they tend to not want to sign on to any kind of philosophical ism. But
sort of Spinoza on steroids kind of thing.
Yeah, right, but many mathematicians are functionally Platonist, even if they don't want to use the term.
There is Pascal's wager,
yeah.
Yes. The There's one up there.
If it's okay, I would like to ask a question, but before I would like to say something about the gentleman's question over there. I think the left-wingers who, there are no left-wingers who don't accept the complexity of a market. I think the left-wing criticism of market is because of harmful effects, which without right. any doubt it is. My question is, you said you are able to distinguish your undergraduates' random series from self-made series?
Well, most of the time, yeah.
So what training do you think led you there, and what training do you think would be necessary for...
They don't put enough consecutive strings of heads and tails in, and they're reluctant if I ask them to list a sequence of 100 H's and T's that represent heads and tails, they're reluctant to put in five or six heads in a row, or tails in a row, or whatever, and they tend to go back, you know, one or two heads, one or two tails, and so that's how I distinguish the real coin from the fake coin, or from not the fake coin, but the made up.
Terry,
look more random. I mean, that would require a better algorithm than the simple-minded one that I use, which is just if there aren't enough. Enough runs, then they probably made it up.
I think we have to move along, unfortunately. We're running out of